Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in South Asia Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I am Lakshita Malik, and I'm co-hosting this interview with Niharika Yadav. We are joined by Professor Shailaja Payak, Taft Distinguished Professor of History, Faculty Affiliate, Women's and Gender and Sexuality Studies, and Asian Studies at the University of Cincinnati. We are in conversation about her book, The Vulgarity of Caste, Dalits, Sexuality, and Humanity in Modern India, published by Stanford University Press in 2022. Welcome, Professor Payak.
Thank you very much.
All right. Niharika, you do want to open and start with the first question?
Absolutely. Thank you both. I want to start, Professor Payak, by asking you about broadly about the idea for the book. So my question is about the journey from your first book, Dalit Women's Education in Modern India, Double Discrimination, which came out in 2014, to this one. In Dalit Women's Education, you chart a first of its kind social and cultural history of education in modern Maharashtra that centers Dalit women's experiences. And one can see the seeds of your current project in the story you track in your first book, both in terms of studying what you call the contingent and circumscribed agencies through which Dalit women imagine new futures for self and community, but also methodologically in terms of the ethnographic mode of history that you adopt for analyzing some of the archival and political silences, structuring experiences of Dalit women. So can you tell our listeners how the plan for this book emerged out of the first one and how you got interested in writing a history of tamasha and of women performers in particular?
Certainly. Before I delve into that, I want to thank Lakshita and Niharika for doing the podcast. And I am very thrilled to talk about the book on this podcast. I think you're doing an amazing work. So I watched tamasha and other popular forms of theater along with films. And as a child, I was very excited about these arts and also enacted the song and the dance performed by women. It was mainly during my field research, you know, from 2000 to 2004 for my first book, as Niharika mentioned, it was the Dalit Women's Education in Modern India, Double Discrimination. It was published in 2014 by Routledge when I interacted with tamasha women. Of course, for this book, I interviewed Dalit women from a range of backgrounds, rural, urban, slums, from middle class households, those who are literate and even the non-literate. And I came across tamasha dancers who mentioned that they could not attend school mostly because they were constantly on the move. And so, you know, this is all, I mean, as I said, you know, as a child, I've always participated in these performances, but as a researcher, I wanted to understand, you know, the social and the political and the ideological constraints and forces that actually rooted tamasha in a caste, in caste patriarchal violence. And mainstream scholars have, you know, neglected Tamasha. And except for one article by an eminent sociologist, Sharmila Rege, there is no systematic analysis of the social life of Tamasha. And that is what, you know, I wanted to analyze. So Tamasha, which is, you know, a popular form of public theater, practiced predominantly by Dalits and is considered a Dalit traditional art, I wanted to understand as to, you know, why the theater and, you know, this kind of performance, and especially women in there, were often branded ashleel, that is vulgar, and bibhatsa, that is disgusting, by the larger society. And so, of course, this is, you know, per the morally driven modern ethic of the pre-colonial, colonial, and the post-colonial state, the elites, as well as, you know, some ordinary people participating in this. And so, you know, bringing my work, you know, on Dalit women and, you know, now taking it to, so those were respectable Dalit women that were needed for the Dalit movement and the liberation of Dalits, I moved to the so-called non-respectable or dishonorable Dalit women. And of course, I repeat, the so-called, so these dishonor and disrespect in quotes, so I'm questioning these categories. So to understand them, I constructed and, you know, conceptualized this concept of the sex, gender, caste, which is, you know, to understand the structural complexities of sexual and gendered arrangements of the caste system as they have operated to oppress Dalit Tamasha women. And to investigate these entangled histories, I developed the sex, gender, caste complex and also the Ashleel Manuski Asli complex as they were embodied by these women who the larger society thinks, you know, are embodying some kind of sexual excess. So I analyzed the conjugated oppression of vulgarity, sex, sexuality, caste, class, gender, and popular culture, and illuminate how this came about in the 20th century and how different actors, you know, such as the British, high caste elites, Maharashtra state, and Dalits engage with rowdy and this carnivalesque tamasha for their own purposes.
Yeah, thank you so much for that answer, Professor Payak. And we'll be getting into a lot of the things that you mentioned a little bit later in the interview. For now, I wanted to ask you a question around the region. Right. So a key site through which you engage with the questions of caste, identity and culture is not the nation, which a lot of researchers and theorists default to, but the region. In this case, it's Maharashtra. In your book, you trace the history of the region by centering performing arts like Tamasha and Lavani. Could you tell us a little bit about how the region became so important in your work and especially in the histories of complex caste violence? And I'm thinking here of the projects of like Marathi Karan and that carry the Brahminical and colonial legacies of caste exploitation.
Yeah, definitely. So in my work, I mean, both, you know, my first book and my second book, the region actually provides an in-depth analysis of the conjugated oppressions of caste, gender, and sexuality at the local level. So the region, in this case, Maharashtra, is an important site for the study of the functioning of the feudal caste patriarchal system. Both, you know, it shows us the fluidity as well as the tightening during certain historical periods. So Brahmanism was a powerful ideology, although it was simultaneously accompanied by a critique and anti-caste thought. In the 18th century, the Brahmin Peshwa and the Brahmin state bureaucracy preserved and tightened the caste system. They strictly upheld the Brahmin state order and created, at least ideologically, a Brahmanical Hindu kingdom. The ethic of the elites... It sharpened, you know, a similar Brahmanism during colonial times. and especially since the end of the 19th century, in order to preserve the spiritual core of modern Maharashtra. After independence, this process of legitimization sharpened even further. And so this is the story I track in the book. I show as to how this the region, it actually provides a microcosm of the casted, gendered, sexual practices and a deeper access to social life, which is spread in the bylanes and the local libraries, and it can be extended to the national level. So as such, we see that the post-independence project of Marathikaran was in a dialogical relationship with pan-Indian politics. It was tied to the making of the modern Indian nation, on common grounds of, for example, script or linguistic heritage, artistry, as regional imagination emerged alongside the national.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for answering that question, Professor Payak. And this immediately leads me into, obviously, the biggest sort of concept in this book, one of the key concepts in this book, which is the sex, gender, caste complex. And I'm particularly interested in the methodological practices of your book. You draw on a wide range of regional and archival records, Peshwa patronage records, various colonial records, as well as ethnographic modes of inquiry, analysis of visual performing cultures. There's a lot that went into this book as far as methodology is concerned, a wide array of methodological sites that you draw from. Could you talk to us about the Pachi Tamasha archive through which you flesh out the contours of this sex, gender, caste complex?
Yeah, definitely. So, when I started on this project, even I was quite nervous about, the archives. I mean, I certainly know there's a lot of secondary literature on Tamasha. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, I also grew up watching these Marathi films, especially, Tamasha-based films. So certainly, there are a lot of different kinds of archives, right? And so this is where, I wanted to, and this is, again, going back to my first book, how I have weaved together these different sites of knowledge. So in this book also, I combine ethnographic fieldwork with, oral histories and with a close reading of a variety of Marathi archival materials, like, memoirs, biographies, autobiographies, poems, proverbs, films, documentaries, newspapers, magazines, and books. And this is, the Pachi archive, which is very multi-layered, which is also very fragmented. And there are contested narratives that emerge about Tamasha and Tamasha women. This Pachi archive also illuminated the differences in, touchables and untouchables readings of Tamasha. So for example, as the first chapter shows, touchables and untouchables had contrasting views of Paulabai, the first modern Dalit woman performer, dancer and singer. So, I point out to these problems of, lack of documentation, especially because of the stickiness of Ashleel or the vulgar to figures like Paulabai, despite of her being an absolutely, famous star. So we clearly see that, like in other communities, inside and outside of Maharashtra, the Dalit community also engaged, in a vibrant print and public culture. And they contested the existing idioms, codes, and practices of caste, gender, religion, and sexuality. And they created their own new versions to supplant them. And Marathi newspapers published by dominant castes also do not have even fragments of the news I refer to in my book. And of course, the English newspapers and literature also produced by dominant castes and mostly savarnas were rarely interested in Dalits' ideas and what other Dalits thought about caste, untouchability, identity, gender or sexuality. So they all neglected the Dalit surplus woman. And, you know, socially mobile, anxious Dalits also did not want to mention these women in their newspapers or associate themselves with any sort of ashlil or women of ill repute, as they would say. So that is why the Tamasha archive is very patchy and inconsistent. And I had to recreate the muted voices and the suppressed subjectivities of Tamasha women through writings of men. And, you know, and of course, most significantly through oral histories. So for example, to give you, you know, an example, chapter one, which, you know, where I have recreated the history of, and that this is the first history of Pawarabai. And, you know, we come across merely sentences, you know, in the biography of Bapu Rao. So, you know, and these sentences also, you know, cause a lot of violence to the entity of Pawarabai. And that is the kind of woman that emerges. But at the same time, you know, juxtaposing the memoir and the biography and some secondary sources, you know, I have tried to weave together Pawarabai's life story. So I'm very happy that I was able to do so by putting these pieces together, you know, in working with this patchy archive. Yeah, so it was challenging and at the same time very exciting.
Yeah, my next question actually follows on that. So this is a great segue, because you come up with two ways to describe the methodology that you adopt to negotiate this patchy archive. One is, of course, the vernacular as method, which you talk about, which is, you know, both reading these unexplored archives in Marathi, but also using vernacular concepts and political languages, and particularly the concepts of ashlil, asli, manuski, as, and then you also say in one place, can you also use the other kind of reading on this patchy archive, you say connected histories. So here I was really, really, really taken in by your suggestion about the need to write connected histories of Dalits and dominant castes to study what you call the interlocking technologies through which the sex, gender, caste complex works to structure all kinds of hierarchies and that shape our experiences, not just of caste, but of class and gender. So in this regard, as you mentioned, the second chapter presents a kind of exemplary connected history in which you show how very different resources are available to two Tamasha performers, you know, Bapu Rao, who's Brahmin, male, and Pawarabai, who's a female Dalit. And you... the connected history that you show is absolutely stunning in how you are able to then show that the very resources that Pawarabai uses to transform her performance into what you call, quote, her Dalitness and artistry into possibility was constrained by the same social power and capital that Bapu Rao was able to use to kind of boldly denounce his caste and caste privilege. So you show how the stickiness... And this is also a concept I'd love for you to elaborate on, of the charge of ashlil or vulgar is made to kind of stick to Pawarabai's performance. And this is very directly linked to the resources that Bapu Rao can use to claim authentic Marathi cultural identity. So can you share some more reflections on this idea of connected histories? Because I see many possibilities of this concept for writing kind of anti-caste histories of South Asia.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. So see, this is one of my most important contributions. So we have works, you know, by scholars who have either focused on, you know, just like, for example, they're focused only on the Brahmins, or they're focused on Dalits, or, you know, they're focused on, you know, Rajputs or so on. But we haven't really talked about the connections between these different communities. So that is what I have, you know, tried to show that we need to look at, you know, people who are located in these different social locations and how they are actually interacting with each other and, you know, drawing upon each other's expertise. For example, here we see Bapurao doing that with, you know, Paulabai and Mahars and monks he comes across, and how he is able to really, you know, he's able to appropriate their arts and their cultures. And at the same time, you know, it does reveal some possibilities of an anti-caste critique, but at the same time, there are limitations, right? So there are all these different lines that we come across. And at the same time, you know, connections between people and how they came together in certain historical conjunctures to shape certain politics, right? Here, you know, yes, an anti-caste critique to an extent, but at the same time, it also shows the fissures and the predicaments and, you know, the problems that erupted because of the lack or the limitations to their thinking as well as practice. So that was one, you know, important line of thought that I have pursued. And the second one is, you know, showing how the stickiness of caste and the ashleel, the way it attaches not to a task or even the art primarily, but to the body of the person that performs it. And thus, you know, forecloses economic opportunities for some people beyond tamasha. So here, stickiness, you know, I draw upon Ambedkar, who, of course, himself did not use the word ashleel, but he did capture the essence of the ashleel sticking to the untouchable when he referred to what he called protective discoloration that cannot be peeled off and that prevents the realization of an authentic selfhood. So stickiness here is the outcome of repeated impressions. It is an effect that emerges from these histories of contact. So as we say, for example, you know, between Paulabai and Bapurao in the first chapter, or for example, you know, in the film chapter, so we see as to how it emerges in this contact between the elites and tamasha actors. So we see that, you know, in this stickiness actually emerges from these cultural and personal exchanges, and also those exchanges repeat meaning and resonance. And, you know, it results in what the anthropologist Sarah Ahmed has called an accumulation of affective value. And that is stickiness. So I show that the stickiness attached to Dalit Tamasha, I mean, the performance as a whole, as well as, you know, moments to, and the performers, as well as at moments to the Dalit community as a whole. So for example, when all Dalits are, while all Dalits are considered polluted, some, like Tamasha women, they were considered more polluting, more ashleel than others. So even inside the Dalit community, we come across, you know, these different layers. And as a result, we see that to radical Dalits, this ashleel actually disrupted their march to modernity and manuski. Because the ashleel in every minute form, it prevented Dalits from becoming fully human. And so this is the stickiness of vulgarity and caste pollution. And so I show how vulgarity and caste pollution colluded. So this stickiness of caste for Brahmins would be, you know, accumulation of their privilege and power. And that would make an even stronger Brahmin personhood. But the same stickiness of caste, you know, sticking, accumulating over time, it cannot be easily altered. When it stuck to Dalits, it compounded Dalit subalternity, stigmatizing and subjecting them even further. So we see that, you know, for example, in the case of Bapurao, he muffled untouchables' voices and silenced them as soon as they produced lavanya. He appropriated their lavne, and he even imprinted his signature, you know, on his lavne. So even though he sang a lavne, which was supposed to be, you know, ashleel, vulgar, Bapu Rao, this Brahmin man, does not become vulgar, right? And like the untouchables. So this is the stickiness of vulgarity. It stuck to the untouchables and left touchables like Bapu Rao free.
Right. Thank you so much for that. And stickiness, as we learn throughout your book, is such an important concept, which allows me to then segue into this concept of manuski. So you provide such a nuanced critique of, and this is again related to questions of Dalit masculinity, which simply are understood in the literature as replicating problems of Brahminical heteropatriarchy. And you very much contend that, and you very much critique that. In fact, you engage with Ambedkar's complex understanding of manuski denied to Dalits under Brahminical power regimes, and how it was meant to be extended to Dalit men and women equally, not just men, right? So not only does manuski then differ from liberal human rights discourses, but is also not the same as dominant caste, middle class respectability politics. So manuski, which is humanity, right? That's not the same as either of these things. This is particularly evident in how you understand Jalsa and its relationship to Tamasha and Lavanya, which again also brings together this question of stickiness, vulgarity, and what one must do to quote-unquote escape it. Could you please get into some of these complicated understandings of manuski and Dalit masculinity?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and so I've been, you know, as I said, this is the first work that has really unearthed these concepts in the vernacular Marathi for us. And it has been, you know, an absolutely fantastic experience, you know, working with these hitherto neglected concepts and, you know, ideologies and intellectual contributions of Dalits. So here, you know, we see that, of course, you know, as we know through different histories of different regions in India, Dalits struggle to recuperate their humanity and dignity, which is manuski in Marathi, and this is the word that is used by Ambedkar. So they wanted to recuperate their manuski and lift themselves up, raising their moral status in the eyes of the dominant castes and the colonial government to assert their asli status. So although on the exterior, some passed as touchables, Dalits could not easily escape the stickiness of caste or separate it from their lower status to become casteless. And so therefore, they've always already, you know, ashlil, unlike the modern touchables. Although Savarna women were performing in Tamasha and Lavani programs or Tamashe in films, it was very a tentative monetary arrangement for them. They were not stigmatized like hereditary Dalit Tamasha women. So, you know, Savarna women could ride their scooters to the theater, dance and sing. And, you know, after the show, they could very easily return to their respectable homes as normal, modest and modern women. However, you know, the abject Dalit Tamasha woman was excluded from such fame, and they did not enjoy this privilege and luxury. They were afflicted by poverty and the stickiness of vulgarity and stigma of caste. So that is, you know, how I see how manuski, you know, actually was a concept that Ambedkar, you know, worked through, and how it eluded, it excluded Dalits, and especially the Dalit Tamasha woman. However, when we look at when we think about the intersections of popular practices, which are, you know, there's certainly caste patriarchal based cultural forms such as Tamasha, and sexual labor, gender, human, and Dalitness. Again, there is, you know, scholars have, you know, paid little attention, and when they have thought about gender and Dalitness in the same analytical framework, their analysis also tends to flatten or misinterpret certain gendered processes vis-a-vis Dalitness and humanity. So they also do not, these scholars also do not provide any specific contents and contours of what it actually means, what is meant by Dalit masculinity as such, and its historical transitions in the early 20th century. So this is where, you know, yes, on the first glance, it may seem that Ambedkar is also trying, you know, using his patriarchal power to domesticate the surplus Tamasha woman. However, I think, you know, this requires a deeper thought and deeper analysis as to what it actually meant. So, for example, you know, like, for example, some scholars they tend to think that Dalit masculinity is a merely mimicry of dominant norms of manhood. And on the other, it reproduces a one-dimensional view of, you know, quote-unquote suffering, battered and thrashed Dalit women at the hands of Dalit men. So this is where I think, you know, this is a very simplistic reading. And so I show that my book shows that patriarchy is first of all, a hierarchical relationship among men. And in this case, especially the British and touchable men. So, you know, we know as to how the British characterize colonized Indian men as inherently inferior, but also differentiated among them through a hierarchy of manliness and masculinity. So patriarchies always operate in a relational manner, and they are subjected to a wider political economy. So elite feminists easily elide how masculinities are produced differently at different complex intersections of class, family, gender, community, and nation. And in fact, it is Dalit's subordinate and, you know, so-called uncivilized masculinity that rendered them not male, that rendered them irrelevant, threatening, and dangerous to touchables. So it is these tenuous processes that make Dalit men more vulnerable to disciplining and sanitization. So we need to, understand how, like, for example, as to how, you know, current historiography largely fails to recognize how certain gender political strategies, such as, you know, for example, constructing warrior genealogies and military pasts, or entering the army, or a founding of the Samata Sainik Dal in 1927, and attempts to eradicate supposedly Ashleel women from Dalit Samaj, were attempts not first and foremost to conform to or reproduce or challenge colonial or Brahmani gender norms, but they were to generate a unique Dalit Manus and Manuski in the context of sex, gender, caste discourses about docile, dirty, childlike, deficient, or effeminate Dalit men and hypersexualized Dalit women. So Ambedkar very often intentionally invoked Dalit masculinity as a facet of Manuski to challenge Dalit men and women to defend their rights and liberties and sustain their autonomy and independence. So, you know, therefore, you know, sometimes, you know, scholars, and it's no surprise that, you know, Dalit response entailed Manuski. But here again, we need to understand that Manuski and masculinity are hedged, and most importantly, we need to understand the transformative potential of this modern politics of Manuski. And so perhaps, you know, we see with Ambedkar and even like what the Jalsakars were trying to do, the marginalization of women was necessary to this making of Dalit Manuski, a new dignified humanity. And perhaps this exclusion of women from Tamasha and Jalsa was necessary to secure societal recognition of Dalit Manuski, because there was no non-patriarchal, gender egalitarian model of Manuski available. So these were intensely troubled, processes. But we need to also understand that, you know, this is not just a completely patriarchal move. there is something that is at stake, which is humanity and dignity for Dalits. So how do you work through these different pressures? So that is what I'm trying to do in the book.
Right. No, that was great. Thank you so much for taking the time to unpack that with us over here. And that is really in the essence of the book. And so my next question is to talk through things about like invisible labor and specifically the vulnerability to everyday and more structural, not that they are mutually exclusive, forms of violence that Dalit women have to experience. And I ask this in the light of like, it's an academic interest now in understanding pleasure and maza and joy and whatnot. But you really braid those questions and in fact pose a question to what pleasure looks like for different kinds of bodies and how that may be just braided in structurally with instances of violence and not just instances, just an entire structure of violence and exploitation. So could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, definitely. And here, you know, this, as you said, you know, maza, and in the other word that I come across is nakra. So, so you know how scholars and you know lay people talking about, oh, the woman is, you know, doing a lot of nakra. Like in, you know, every people seem to be just oblivious to, you know, how this pleasure is rooted in caste violence, and you know they just invisibilize the work of these relationships of power and caste and economics. So, for example, you know, tamasha is actually rooted in two Marathi words. You know, it was referred to as khel, it is play, and you know, gammat, which is fun, you know, humor. And colloquially, the word has come to mean, you know, fun, nonsense, a tantrum, or even disorder and commotion. So tamasha is this, you know, this nexus. And this is the nexus of play and work that I'm interested in. And this is how tamasha is conveniently naturalized and normalized. So that is what I have challenged. And many tamasha people also agreed that tamasha was kala, which is art, or Lakshmi, you know, goddess of wealth, and of course, you know, means their means of livelihood, and some underlined, you know, exhaustive training and rehearsals. Tamasha was also it also expected tamasha women to play rather than work, right? So in this process, we clearly see that this kala or khel invisibilize the work and the relationships of power and caste and the political economy in tamasha. So as such, you know, the form and the actors, they reduce Dalits to singing and playing music and dancing. And, you know, until the current day, and tamasha women worked on this reiterative body politics of erotic excess, for example, emphasizing bold bodily gestures, that is winking the left eye or accentuating the and deploying certain body parts, you know, openly expressing sensuality, and you know, and expressing lovemaking or sexual enjoyment for their predominantly touchable male audience. And we clearly see that in this process, work is, and in this practice, work is looked upon as productive, and play is its opposite, its antithesis, its play is looked upon as unproductive. So different touchables and untouchables, they harness, you know, tamasha for doing some work, for by putting the unproductive to productive use. And of course, women did the most important work that was rendered play, because of the presumably unruly energies, aimless and simple enjoyments that tamasha provided. So as play in the sense of drama or even play between the artist and the audience, tamasha lacked utility. And the play and playfulness of tamasha has mass appeal and touchables and untouchables, they also deployed it for their, you know, their own gains. So by sanitizing tamasha, touchable elites put the resistance and rebellious energy of tamasha to the work of carving asli identity. Thus, the quote-unquote play of tamasha, you know, successfully occludes work in the sense that the always already sexually alienated labor of the Dalit tamasha woman performer, it produces the surplus that keeps the sexual caste economy in place. And we clearly see this, you know, in different chapters, especially chapter one. And tamasha and its practitioners, they, you know, also paradigmatically represented the excess, the waste of the world. So as such, you know, there's always this violence at play with regard to Dalit culture, artistry, and creativity in this fun-filled tamasha. And although, you know, all touchable men enjoyed tamasha and tamasha women, they also devalued the work of tamasha women and rendered them unproductive and surplus. So on the one hand, there's this management of surplus through a set of, you know, through a set of iterative practices of negative control. And in the other, there's a marking of surplus as negative and corrosive and yet necessary in order to assert this asli caste selfhood of savarnas. So the fun and play, tamasha, was, you know, kala, kaam, and the performance of sensual play for tamasha women, and relaxation, amusement, entertainment, an opportunity to feel like a real man, quote-unquote real man, for the touchable men in the audience. So tamasha women, you know, which was supposed to be their play, but they're actually working, enabling men to laugh, to joke, make lewd comments or pat each other on the back and flirt and dance and drink. And men structured their manliness and masculine behaviors mainly with, you know, this tamasha woman who excited and stimulated them. So the everyday work and sustenance of tamasha women depended on their complying, challenging, negotiating, bending, and transgressing of traditional patriarchy through an excessive performance of the erotic and the exotic. So there was this double system of work and play in tamasha. Work was concealed behind play. And most important, the meaning of play was fashioned to accommodate that of work. And yet the work of tamasha woman and these, you know, the different tamasha women I interviewed and, you know, who are portrayed in the book was depicted as non-work, especially in the culture of India that values hard work. And as a result, time pass, as we call it, has a negative connotation.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, actually, you in this kind of in investigating this paradox that the performance and performativity of tamasha enables, you tell another very, very important connected history, right? Like the appropriation, the devaluing, but then appropriation of tamasha to especially in post-colonial Maharashtra to produce Marathi cultural identity, but the very constrained and circumscribed kind of agency that allows to the tamasha women performers themselves in order to construct selfhood. And you describe this selfhood as self in community. And I want to return to this question of the samaj and how you broadly sketch this very complex, what you call ambivalent agency of tamasha women and its relationship to the Dalit samaj that Ambedkar's Manus Ki configures. And so my question is really about how, and I'm interested in this question because in a way, the modern concept of society as we know it is incommensurable with these kind of disjunctive hierarchies of order based in caste. And you show how the Dalit samaj actually offers a very particular figuration of the social, not composed of abstract or equal individuals, but as you show, of a self in community. So I was wondering if you could elaborate for our listeners how tamasha women figure in this self in community and how their relationship to the Dalit social engenders some new meanings of community or of samaj. And in particular, you know, it comes towards the end as you talk about your interview with Mangalathai, this complex negotiation that Dalit Tamasha performers have with the figure of the quote prostitute woman in thinking of their own agency, their own negotiations with very constrained but opening up possibilities for respectability, agency, selfhood in community. So that's a long-winded question, but I hope you can elaborate on this kind of relationship of the Dalit women performers to Samaj. Yeah,
sure. Yes. So the concept of Samaj and the self in community, as I call it, is also very, very central, because we clearly see that Ambedkar is, you know, he's trying to build community, however fuzzy it might be, but at the same time, you know, is very successful in bringing together the Samaj in order to, you know, in order to fight for personhood, you know, this dignity and humanity, manuski, that was denied to Dalits. So bringing together, you know, these disparate threads, you know, this but trying to bring together this collectivity of Dalits. And again, here I want to emphasize that yes, there were a lot of contradictions amongst Dalits themselves as to, you know, how they wanted to, you know, view and, you know, what liberation looked like for them, but at the same time all agreed and were committed to the cultivation of, for example, you know, manuski, which was important to protect basic civic and human rights and cultivate untouchables' worthiness to gain citizenship, freedom and equality. So the problem Ambedkar faced was not of responding to characterizations of Dalit men as effeminate and Dalit women as ashleel, but of this tenuous process of reforming, maintaining manuski, carving out a positive manus, and becoming, you know, quote-unquote civilized and quote-unquote cultured, and adopting certain respectable moral standards in order to be accepted by the larger Indian society. And here, yes, you know, even some responses, such as, for example, founding of the Samta Sainik Dal entailed a performance of a hegemonic masculine norm, or the caste, or the sex, gender, caste complex. It also unequally burdened Dalit women with accusations of immorality and vulgarity. And thus, this new Dalit woman, she was burdened with these, you know, pressures and consequences of the reform of the Dalit Samaj. And, you know, caste assumptions led to hierarchies of purity and pollution, superiority and inferiority, decency and degradation, highness and lowness, and, you know, an order and danger. They created devastation on both sides of the caste divide and produced a less generous society and excluded untouchables from the common weal. So Dalit women's sentiments, attachments, and commitment emphasize that these projects of building a Samaj, or even the projects of Dalit feminism in a doubly colonial Brahmani and British colonial context, and the articulation of gender and sexuality, as well as, you know, the Dalit revolution, are never predetermined. So there is no just one way of bringing together the Dalit Samaj, and, you know, or just one way of thinking about, for example, the project of Dalit feminism or Dalit humanism. They are to be negotiated according to historical moments, as well as caste, race, class positions. And, you know, thinking about, you know, how Mangalathai or Tamasha women, you know, how they were negotiating and interacting with this Samaj. I mean, clearly we see that Dalit men, including, you know, Ambedkar and the Jalsakars that we come across in the book, are intensely troubled by the exploitation of women like Paulabai in the theater of Tamasha. And because they sought to recuperate a certain humanity, you know, a certain swabhiman or self-respect and manuski for all Dalits, and remaking of the honor of the most degraded woman was critical to Dalit self in the community in a doubly colonial context. So yes, there are tensions, but we also see as to how, for example, women like Mangaltai, you know, continue to negotiate with the Dalit and the non-Dalit Samaj, you know, so who are dealing with a double patriarchy, both inside and outside. And they have to make certain critical decisions when they are trying to, you know, do this. So, for example, this, you know, one is, yes, they understand that, you know, their relationship to with the Dalit social is very fraught. And at the same time, they are also provided, you know, some opportunities of self-making. There is some resistance that is tolerated. But again, you know, only if they act within particular boundaries. However, from the end of the 20th century, and especially in the 21st century, we also clearly see as to how Dalit women have pushed, you know, these boundaries of the Dalit Samaj, carving out, you know, their own status, financial and social. And as I have mentioned, and as Niharika pointed out, in the conclusion of the book, I show as to how they have formed an acquisitive, responsible, and self-interested ethic through which they could remake themselves and their families, and just, you know, show as to, you know, how they were embraced by the Samaj, but at the same time, again, you know, very, very fraught. They are embraced, and at the same time, you know, they are also, they could be depicted as vulgar women. So these are the contradictions and pressures and the tenuous moments that we come across. So on the one hand, certainly the Dalit Samaj offers this, you know, very concrete instances of building self in the community, despite of hierarchies and despite of, you know, differences in ideologies. And at the same time, there are also these moments when things may collapse or things may be taken to newer, higher, you know, grounds where women are pushing these boundaries.
Yeah, thank you so much. And you show this so beautifully in the text. I'm really stopping myself from going into lengthy quotations where you kind of sketch this, what you call an ambivalent agency, so wonderfully. And you show how rather than being about kind of claim to certain kinds of stable identity, it's really about opening possibilities and oriented towards the future. And again, I'm holding myself back from quoting, but looking towards the future and in that sense, you know, opening up possibilities, I wanted to talk about some sources or some of the critical conversations that your work participates in. So, of course, you engage with Ambedkar and the writing of An Activism of Dalits. You also talk about, you also kind of bring or engage with feminist anti-caste critics like Sharmila Rege, Gail Lombard, Vigita in particular, but also theorists of race and imperialism. You draw especially on Saidiya Hartman, Sylvia Winter, Fanon. And so can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you draw insights from these different conversations, how you connect them and kind of produce your own insights, and also you know, what you think are the contributions of your work in particular, and maybe this complex picture of agency that you sketch to these conversations?
Yeah, definitely. So I have really, benefited from, and you know, I have drawn upon and built upon scholars who have worked on these complicated interlocking technologies, as I call them, of caste, gender, race, sexuality, popular culture. And so that is where, you know, the scholars that you come across in the book, and as Niharika mentioned, you know, they have been extremely, you know, critical to my work. So, for example, you know, I see that the book is able to not only, you know, build on, but also, you know, build a new foundation for thinking about the conjugated operations of caste, race, gender, and sexuality. So, you know, this is showing us that, you know, my analysis of oppressed subjectivities of Dalit women is not constrained to the South Asian Indian context, but it is applicable to, you know, non-South Asian context. And I have benefited from reading and working with Ambedkar, Sylvia Winter, Saidiya Hartman, Fanon, and Achil Mbembe, in terms of, you know, thinking about the Dalit human. So it has been a wonderful, you know, linking and connecting these insights of Black scholars with Dalit scholars and, you know, and some non-Dalit scholars to understand what and how we can think and, you know, what, for example, Ambedkar may be focusing on when he's talking about Manuske for Dalits. So this is where, you know, I am, you know, connecting them and advancing, you know, their insights to understand this humanness of Dalits and the way they were trying to build humanity and dignity, something that has not been done. And this is how I write, which I, you know, this is what I, you know, this is my contribution to this global history of sexuality and gender and social inequality and humanity. So the key insights that, you know, that I bring to the table are basically of humanity, of understanding, you know, the sex, gender, caste complex, of understanding how certain communities are looked upon as vulgar and, you know, non-human for that matter, and because of the ways social inequality operates, and drawing upon these different theorists in different locations and how they have tried to understand, you know, humanity has, you know, helped me connect not only these different lives, but also sharpen the focus on how people construct their own agency.
Right. Thank you so much. That was, you sat through so much of this with us. I am really thankful that you went into so much detail with us. And of course, it's a wonderful book. Strongly recommend everyone to go out and get a copy and engage with it. It was fabulous.
Yeah, I can assure all the listeners that we barely scratched the surface in terms of the many conceptual insights of this book. And, you know, we're actually not even going through all of our questions since we're running out of time. But yeah, again, I want to echo Lakshita that I really encourage everyone to read the book.
Yeah. Just one final question about your upcoming projects. What can we expect to read from you? I, for one, am really excited. I'm sure Niharika is too, to hear that.
Definitely, again, you know, I'm very excited to share that I have an article coming out, and the title of the article is To Kiss or Not to Kiss.
Interesting.
That sounds great.
So I'm very excited about that. And again, you know, once again, focusing on kissing and, you know, vulgarity and the regeneration and the remaking of the Maharashtra state, especially in, you know, the in post-colonial times. And I'm also I'm also editing a book on caste and race in South Asia and in South Asia and beyond. And I am the Cambridge Companion to Ambedkar is a forthcoming. So these are the different projects that I'm working on. And lastly, I'm at the National Humanities Center this year working on, you know, so going into the politics of the vulgar in the 19th century. So this is what I'm occupied with right now.
Thank you so much, Professor Pike. We look forward to all of those wonderful projects.
Well, thank you very much. This was an incredible pleasure. Yes, I'm very, very thrilled talking about my work with you. Thank you very much for the questions and for the engagement.
Thank you so much, Professor Payak. I have interrupted you now twice, so I'm just going to stop recording before it gets worse.